Incorporated and Valtech Services Incorporated. Counsel that are arguing today, will you please announce yourselves?
David Cole, Your Honor, the appellant, Mark Stone. Okay.
Your Honor, Jeffrey Bass for the appellant.
Okay. I'd like to welcome you to the Fifth Court of Appeals. It's an honor to be sitting here today alongside Justice David Evans and Justice Aaron Nowell. Just a few housekeeping items before we begin. Will everybody in the courtroom please put your phones on silent? We do not allow any audio or visual recordings, and neither are photographs. All I ask is each time you take the podium, would you please announce yourselves, because this proceeding is being recorded, and I don't think this is either of y'all's first time to be in the court. Be in front of us, but just in case, the timer system, each side's going to be given 20 minutes. A yellow light will come on when you have a three-minute warning. If the red light comes on and you're still answering a question from one of the justices, please go ahead and finish your answer, and we will be given a five-minute rebuttal to the appellant, and a one-minute yellow warning will be given. Please be assured we've read the briefs and the pertinent parts of the record, and we're ready and familiar with the issues, and we look forward to hearing your arguments. So, and on that note, we may begin.
Testing. Ah, it works. Good morning. It may please the court. David Cole for the appellant, Cornerstone. If a contract calls for me to supply the counterparty with a dog, but instead of that, I supply an animal that has four legs and fur and is cute and cuddly, but is nevertheless a cat, I have not complied with the contract. There is a material difference. There are some superficial similarities. There is common vocabulary, fur, leg, animals, so on and so forth. But in spite of that, they are distinct. They're different from each other. And that is the issue in this case. There is a dog. It is the requirement in this agreement that we have a certain type of financial statement very specifically defined to be used to calculate whether or not this payment is due. And we have evidence in the trial record of a lot of cats. We have data. We have interpretations. We have a lot of different things. But what we don't have is the specific type of audited financial report as of a certain date of a specific entity as required by the contract. The record on that point is quite simple, and why I think the case for reversal is quite compelling. We have this in our argument exhibit. It's Exhibit 53. This is the relevant page of the consolidated audited financial statement of Valtech SE as of December 31st, 2015. It is the summary that Valtech SE, the parent entity, put in its publicly filed financial information that was audited of its American businesses that it sold off. There is admittedly some dispute in the record as to what exactly this is, but it is a couple of truths are unimpeachable about this. It is not what was used as the basis for the APA demand in this case. They have nothing to do with each other. And it is undisputed that there obviously Valtech had no problem putting this summary of its American, North American operations into its parents' financial statements and submitting them to the auditors. This document is what was there, but nothing stopped it from taking another form.
Let me ask you just really quick so that I can get oriented to this, because it took me a while in reading the briefs. As I understand where we are, you are not bringing forward any complaint about the charge.
That is correct.
The charge did express that it asked whether there was a breach, and it said in order to find that there's a breach, the jury would have to find that the condition in the APA was not met.
It refers expressly to that. You're right.
Prior to that, you'd move for summary judgment. You'd move for instructed verdict. After judgment, you moved for post-judgment motions, each time arguing that, as a matter of law, the condition was as you are arguing it here today.
Correct.
They had argued not so. They had argued it means what they say it means, and the judge did not grant anybody any ruling based on a matter of law and basically submitted it as an ambiguous contract, letting you fully argue whatever you said the condition means, and you even are going to show us some trial exhibits for that, and let them argue whatever they say the condition means, and the jury heard both of those things. It fits into the charge where it says to find that there's a breach, you must find that they met the condition. And so the jury found that the condition was met.
I agree with everything you said up to ambiguity was tried. It wasn't. The court did not find that this agreement was ambiguous, and the submission is not an ambiguity submission. It's not the form language about you should give meaning to this provision.
I totally agree with you, but how else can we interpret this when it says you got to meet the condition? And what you and I both know is when you try this kind of a case, the court says what it means. If there's a dispute and if the court thinks it's ambiguous, there's a separate ambiguity submission. That was not used here, but there's no objection to this charge that's brought forward on appeal.
The question is, here is the language of the – you could put the whole language in there. Here is the contract provision. Was it breached? And the jury heard the evidence and concluded that there had been a breach. But the meaning of that contract provision is a question of law. Before the verdict, after the verdict,
unless
here
it's
today,
ambiguous.
Which wasn't the issue submitted, which wasn't what the trial court found, and isn't the way it should be resolved here. If this court finds it to be ambiguous, unlike what the trial court did, I suppose it can then look at the record in a different way. My contention is it is unambiguous. If the court finds it's ambiguous, it's going to have to get into some parole evidence. Even then, in that inquiry, you, of course, would begin with the plain language of the agreement and reason back from there.
Would you characterize your interpretation of the clause as diametrically opposed to their interpretation of the clause?
We say it had to look like this, and they say it didn't.
Right. And diametrically opposed, right?
Well, as is any agreement about what an unambiguous contract means.
The judge let you both argue that to the jury without deciding that question.
I don't agree with that. The question of what the contract meant was argued as a matter of a legal question at summary judgment, pre-charge objection phase, and then directed verdict stuff after trial. That's a purely legal argument. At the trial, people argued about compliance and performance. Now, that has a lot of overlap, kind of like my cat-dog example, talking about audited financials and that sort of thing. Did we match up with it? But that's evidence of performance and evidence of breach, properly admitted on that question and properly considered. It was not admitted for the purpose of contract construction or interpretation or meaning and should not be reviewed so by this court.
Okay, thank you.
To that point about what the evidence was about the issue of compliance, the issue of performance, we say it means what it says. You're supposed to have a certain type of financial statement. They say we use the same data. And this is a question, to your point, Justice Evans, this is a question of compliance. Is the same data what is envisioned by this contract language? Did that produce performance? And, of course, it doesn't say that. The agreement does not say data in it. But the problem, the logical problem that surfaces when you think about that for just a second, before you even get into the record, data can be combined in a million different ways. Inadvertently, in producing the exhibits for this argument, I touched off exactly one of those examples. I put in an example of a financial document they had that Valtech had that showed a negative EBITDA during the relevant period. They have taken issue with that. They clashed. They sent back their information. That conversation was supposed to have taken place with the auditors under this agreement. That shouldn't have been an issue that we were arguing about. It shouldn't be an issue that we're arguing about today. The point of this agreement was to take all of that discussion about what the financial statement, what the data says and doesn't say, put it into a financial statement and subject that to the auditing process, in turn producing something that looks like this that would go into the public market. And what would come to us as an IPA demand would be a letter that said, here's an IPA demand. Attached is page 22 from our financial statement, which our auditors have reviewed. The approach of it's the same data is good enough invites exactly what happened here. You have one set of things that goes to the auditors, calculated, by the way, to make them look good and getting rid of the unprofitable business. And then you have another independent calculation done behind the curtain by Valtech, which, of course, is going to favor Valtech. It is an approach that makes the contract meaning illusory if it is accepted. It is an argument for performance that has no validity. The question is raised in their briefing that we couldn't help it. Those crazy auditors, they insist on things being done in a certain way, and what could we do? We look again to the charge. Was the defense of impossibility or failure of consideration tried? It was not. And the testimony of Mr. Predit, who was the senior financial person within the Valtech organization, says, it's volume 9 of the record, page 101 is where this discussion begins. There's a lengthy discussion about this document, the disclosure in their public financial statements about the performance of the American business. There was not any difficulty in Valtech asking its auditors at Deloitte to prepare this. No difficulty by Deloitte in understanding what it was being asked to do, and no difficulty in producing it at the end of the day. So the idea that we had to do what we did because our auditors trapped us and we had no other option is not a viable argument. Their own acts show that they can control what is submitted to audit, and their own financial leadership says that they can say, tell them what to do and how to do it if it is something that is an appropriate material statement about the finances of the company.
Mr. Cole, if I may, it appears that your briefing appears to argue legal and factual sufficiency of the jury verdict, but it doesn't say specifically what ruling we should correct. Can you help me out?
We argue legal sufficiency. We argue that, as a matter of law, the contract means a certain thing, and that is preclusive and means that the judgment should not stand. The evidence that showed breach and damage is no good because the unambiguous meaning of the contract forecloses that. We don't dispute factual sufficiency. Whatever inferences were there to draw are there to draw. This is a matter of law case based on an unambiguous contract instruction.
Thank you.
Reverse and render is the punchline because there is no evidentiary foundation for any part of the judgment once the correct contract interpretation is applied to it. Exhibit B is the other angle that is used to construe this agreement, to argue about performance, to say what we did was acceptable by Valtech. It was simply a template. We dropped numbers into it. We went on from there. I tossed in an interesting example of why that, I think, is, again, a false light. The Exhibit B that was attached to our asset purchase agreement, everybody agrees, was not accurate. Everybody agrees had estimates placed in the December financials. No one faults anyone for that. We hadn't finished the month of December yet. But they just had some plug numbers in there, so there would be something to look at. The actual demand is made, and what is there? The same plug numbers. They continued forward. If what they did in their demand was real, if it was meaningful, the plugs wouldn't still be there. It's a tell. Is that dispositive by itself? No. But it shows the problem that when they take Exhibit B and say, we can update it, supplement it, fill it in, fold it, whatever, that puts the power in them to decide what it means, how it should be applied, what data satisfies it, and that results in mischief, like we have in this record. At page...
Mr. Coles, if the use of Exhibit B is not what Appali is claiming, that we plug the numbers
right.
in and that's the format because it,
right.
I think their argument was that there were certain subsets
correct.
Of information that related to the assets that were purchased
yes.
versus subsets of information that were related to other assets that were not purchased. Just
that's,
give me that. If that's not the reason for Exhibit B, what is the purpose of Exhibit B?
Exactly what it says it is. It's an illustration of what it generally ought to look like. The types, the topics that should be included generally and the general format it should take with months across the top and yay number of line items down the side. It is not intended to be an exact template, and we know this because the definition of EBITDA, to which this all relates, the first words of that definition define it as the operating income of the business. So if you take Exhibit B and apply it to the situation in a way that produces an inaccurate number or something that might not actually be the operating income of the business, it is suspect. And we know how you're supposed to do that. The other part of the agreement tells us you look at the audited financial statements. To add a little salt and pepper to it, looking at the record, this is volume 13, page 50, they made a number of adjustments. And the type of the adjustments that were made, if you get into that and just look at it and see what was happening, this is Exhibit V-170, illustrates this. They relate to moving obligations around among the Valtech company families. So-and-so booked salary here, so-and-so booked rent there. You kind of move that around. All of that, of course, is on the Valtech side of the fence. That's all their data. We don't have insight into that. That's their own, you know, housekeeping among themselves, which is the whole point of the audit requirement in the first place, is whatever it is they're doing by saying this is part of the business, this isn't part of the business, that is the thing that ought to be subject to audit, because you can't trust somebody, not to be mean about it, it's like Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. When they say, oh, trust us, this is the way we account for all our intercompany stuff, no worries, that's why the auditor had to be involved. So Exhibit B is an illustration of the general format and the language of the agreement, bears me out on that, of the calculation of operating income of the business. Everybody knows what operating income is. The calculation thus had to accurately reflect that, and the way it needed to reflect that was by it being audited by the auditors of the Valtech family as part of the financial statements of that company. Everybody would have assurance at that point.
So your claim is that the agreement basically says, hand this Exhibit B to the auditors. They need to fill out it in the document in this form, and then provide it.
They could do a couple of different things. But what they would need, the basic idea of what they needed to say to their auditors was, we have to make a calculation of EBITDA, as we are obliged to by this agreement. Here's the definition of EBITDA. Here's how we have calculated that. Please audit that so we may put it in our financial statements. And that would happen. There would be an audit, and it would be disclosed to the world. The auditor might or might not ask for adjustments to be made to specific line items in Exhibit B if it was necessary to accurately reflect the operating income of the business. Of course, none of that happened here. This is all their internal. We take Exhibit B, we plug our numbers in, and coincidentally, it happens to produce a number very favorable to them when the number that's disclosed to the outside world is significantly negative. So exactly the form that may have taken, you know, that could have depended on the way that what else the auditors might have been doing that day, other demands of the accounting standards, so on and so forth. But the basic idea is they should have had something that calculated EBITDA that was in the general form and format of Exhibit B that could have been examined for accuracy, compliance with relevant accounting standards, and general overall integrity, so that we would all have some comfort as it when the demand was made, so that the number would be good enough for both the marketplace and for purposes of this agreement.
So I think their argument is we took Exhibit B as a format. The numbers that were required to be put in Exhibit B that was agreed upon were in the consolidated financial audit report. So, therefore, the auditors looked at our numbers on the back end. We plugged those numbers in, and here is our Exhibit B pursuant to the consolidated audited financial statements of Valtech as a whole, not just the business, the assets that you purchased.
So there are a couple of assumptions in that. The first assumption is that data, that simply having the data is acceptable. That the document wasn't actually in a statement, but it was the same data that gives rise to the problems I was talking about before. But then as to Exhibit B, let's just step back for a second and let me challenge the assumption that it was sort of a template you drop things into. If it's exactly what's there, why isn't it the exact same number? I mean, it doesn't say in the agreement, in the definition of EBITDA, it's an Exhibit B is an example, and you can update it. It doesn't say that. It says, you know, what it says about that. The idea of updating, that's their idea. They came up with that. It needs to be updated, enhanced, whatever. And so the fact that you take something and it's binding as to the specific line items, but not binding as to the numbers that are in there anymore, they can change those, I question that. That was an argument made throughout the trial. I was just revisiting the closing argument here a couple of days ago. If Exhibit B means Exhibit B, then darn it, it means Exhibit B. This idea about updating is something they came up with because they didn't want to do the financial statements.
I guess I'm confused because you first said Exhibit B is a form. So, like, it should have month, and it should have date, and it should have these specific line items. And so then the auditor is supposed to take that.
If that's not what I meant to say. It's an example of the format. It should look kind of like that. It would be like having this and saying the disclosure should look sort of like this. This is the general idea of what it ought to look like. And that's what the language of the agreement actually says about it. It says here's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to calculate operating income. And Exhibit B that we've attached to this is an example, generally, of the kind of calculation that we're talking about. It doesn't say it must be exactly Exhibit B. It doesn't say it must be updated. It doesn't say what, if it's going to be updated, it must be updated with. All of that is their gloss on the agreement that allows them to make their own subjective changes to the agreement. The better reading is we look first at what they're supposed to do, which is look at consolidated financial statements. To the extent that has something to do with EBITDA, we looked at that definition. That is defined for us, and then there's a general reference to this exhibit, and we can look at the form of that. That's the hierarchy and the structure of these overall agreements. The idea that you start with Exhibit B, take that, and then fill back in just has it exactly backwards, and it allows them to put their own subjective judgment in numerous places in a way that is not fair to us and allows them to do this, say one thing to the market and another thing to us. The agreement here is one other issue unrelated to this question of the APA. There is an issue as to notice and timely, accurate notice. There is the argument back in the appellee's brief is that there is an issue of waiver. We, I think, more than adequately address that in our closing. I believe it's page 158. There's a link. There's a good-sized couple of paragraph discussion on this very issue. No objection by them. Everyone knew that timeliness and appropriateness of notice was an issue being tried, and that's the cleanest example I could find in reviewing the record in this case. It's an independent ground for reversal in this case. This is a matter of law case. This contract means one thing under any reasonable application of our state's construction of contract principles, and that compels reversal.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
May it please the court, counsel. What should not be lost on this court is the point of this exercise, and that is to determine the intent of the parties in executing this asset purchase agreement, and specifically the purchase price provision. That provision was intended to measure what was sold here, and that was defined by the agreement. What was sold is assets. It's defined by a lengthy definition, including a 32-page exhibit. This was not a sale of Valtech services on the whole. It was a sale of specific assets. To borrow the analogy that counsel used in their brief, this was not a sale of a loaf of bread. This was a sale of specific ingredients. And those ingredients were staffing contracts. And staffing contracts are not an asset that you can value by comparables, and there's no Kelly Blue Book for staffing contracts. You'd have to look at what do they generate? What are the revenues that those types of contracts will generate? What does it cost to fulfill those contracts? These are the revenues minus the expenses. That will show you the earnings. You take those earnings. You know that the contracts are going to generate earnings for multiple years. You would apply a multiple. In this case, the parties agreed on a very specific measure. EBITDA of the business times 4.2, and they would take that measurement at two points in time. Once in 2015 at the end of the year, and again in 2016. So the condition here is whether the EBITDA of the business times 4.2 was greater than 1.9. A component of that condition is that the calculation be pursuant to the consolidated audited financial statements. But Cornerstone's reading is just too narrow. They want to take the position that if the consolidated audited financial statements didn't show EBITDA, or they showed a negative EBITDA, that's the end of it. No initial payment adjustment. But for this court to adopt that reading, you would have to ignore the plain meaning of the terms that have not been defined by the party and the defined terms that the parties have used in the agreement. And there's nothing in the asset purchase agreement that supports Cornerstone's reading that pursuant to means contained within. If Cornerstone wants to disregard the introductory language, they want to disregard pursuant to. Texas law simply does not allow that. Texas law requires that this court harmonize the entire agreement, giving plain and ordinary meaning to the terms that are not defined and following the defined terms that are defined. So what I propose to do for this court today is demonstrate why Valtech Services satisfies Texas law why our construction is reasonable. I'll then show you why Cornerstone's is not reasonable. And if this court finds that both constructions are reasonable, then the contract is ambiguous. And I will demonstrate why Cornerstone's legal sufficiency challenge fails. We start the interpretation of a contract with the language. We submitted an exhibit to the court. On Exhibit 2, we tried to compile most of the defined terms in one place for the court, so it's a little easier to read the agreement in context. And so before we get to the main course, the pursuant to clause, I'd like to set the table with some of the definitions in the agreement. First, we have at the top the defined term business, which is the seller's Valtech Services IT staffing business. It's comprised of the assets that were for sale. The business is the assets in operation. Second, we have the term EBITDA. There's been a lot of discussion of EBITDA. That is a commonly used term in commercial transactions, but it's not a standard term. It's not defined by generally accepted accounting principles, and it's not defined by international financial reporting standards. So when parties use it like this, they have to define it. Here they defined it specifically with reference to a very detailed schedule, a two-page profit and loss statement, which details the revenues that would be included and the expenses that would be included. Again, this is intended to represent the value of the business, which is the assets, not Valtech Services. It's a subset of Valtech Services. And the parties use the term illustrated. Counsel glazes over that. Illustrated means to show clearly, to make clear by giving or serving as an example. This is how the parties agreed they would calculate EBITDA, the earnings of the business that were sold. The provision also requires notice, as we've discussed. It's been adequately briefed no later than April 15th. It also requires that the calculation is subject to the buyer's consent, and the provision ends with the last sentence. The last sentence says the initial payment adjustment will be subject to the buyer's complete and prompt access to the books, records, and calculations of the seller. Again, that's Valtech Services, and its agents, serving as the basis for the initial payment adjustment. This is probably the clearest statement of the party's intent as to how they would calculate the IPA. This says that Valtech Services books and records and calculations will serve as the basis for the IPA, not the consolidated audited financial statements and not the auditors. Now, finally, we get to the initial phrase, if pursuant to the consolidated audited financial statements. Cornerstone doesn't provide a definition for pursuant to, but we do. They want to just disregard it. We provided a definition. It means in compliance with, or in accordance with, or under. Those words don't have a certain indefinite meaning. But the court is not limited to just the language of the words. As Texas Supreme Court set forth in Sun Oil decision in 1981, the court may consider the surrounding circumstances at the time of the transaction when there's a question as to construction and the words don't have a clear and definite meaning. What were the circumstances here? You had two parties negotiating a sale in the month of December. They had agreed that they would dictate value based on the annual earnings. They didn't have a complete year. December wasn't done. One. Second, this company was a spinoff. Valtech Services was formed as an independent entity in the beginning of 2015. Prior to that, it was a division of Valtech Solutions. They were creating these books and records during that year while they were negotiating the sale. Parties knew that, so they built in a true-up mechanism. We'll pay a purchase price, 1.9 at closing, and we'll do a true-up. We'll look at when you finalize the books and records in their final, and they've been audited, calculate EBITDA as we've agreed, send it to us, and give us an opportunity to review it, ask any questions. We have the right to consent. We have the right to your books and records and the calculations serving as the basis for it. And that's why... And they would use that mechanism, that true-up mechanism, in 2015. Do it again in 2016 when Cornerstone owns it. Now, 2015 has the other requirements that I mentioned, and that's why this is so difficult. The asset purchase agreement doesn't give a lot of direction about how you do that. But Cornerstone says start and end with the consolidated audited financial statements. And it's telling. that they never calculated EBITDA in the manner illustrated by Exhibit B. Not once throughout the trial, 2 years of litigation, never calculated EBITDA. They talk about an arbitrary interpretation. They claim that this business, the assets, were losing money. But we present in an exhibit, page 7 of our exhibits, the profit and loss statement of these assets immediately after Cornerstone purchased it, they were profitable. They were profitable in January, February, March, April, and profitable on the year after, with no changes whatsoever. So their position is these assets were worthless, losing money in 2015, but when we bought it and started operating it, we closed on December 31, and on January 1, they're profitable.
Do you understand the meaning of 2.3.2 pursuant to require you to use data that was either in or the same as and audited, that where there was data, the same data, audited by Deloitte?
We construe 2.3.2 to require us to make a calculation that is pursuant to. That does not mean it has to be contained within the documents, but it must be consistent with or reconcilable.
Does it mean you have to pick the numbers out of the audit, or they be the data, as you said in your brief, that was given to the auditors? Auditors approve that data, and that data is audited by the auditors. You're
correct.
Using that data. Do you agree it has to be at least that?
Yes, I do.
Do you think the evidence supports that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is uncontroverted. There was no dispute as to the evidence. Cornerstone only took the position that that's not enough. You have to take it directly from the face of the audit. Any number that appears on the face of that audit is a product of other numbers. If you look at a revenue number on the audit, that's a product of all the revenues for the year. An income number, it's a product of the revenues minus the expenses. So the fact that the number didn't appear doesn't mean that the data that was used was not audited. An audit is a review of all of the data, and the uncontroverted testimony from Mr. Pertet, Valtech's CFO, was that all of the data was submitted to the audit. Its auditors access it by accessing the computerized system. And after they reviewed it, they made no further changes, and then that same information was used to calculate EBITDA for purposes of the IPA. Now, Valtech could have started with the numbers on the face of the audit. They could have done that and then back out the numbers that were not to be required. In fact, if you look at Cornerstone's exhibit that counsel referenced, the uncontroverted testimony about that exhibit was that this document represented the net income from discontinued operations and assets held for sale. It was two companies, not just Valtech Services, but another company called Valtech Technologies. And that is because these audited financial statements are generated under international financial reporting standards. Valtech SE is a European public company with subsidiaries around the globe. They publish their statements. They're required by international financial reporting standards, and the acronym is IFRS. IFRS 5 requires separate treatment of assets held for sale or discontinued operations. Counsel mentioned the way when he mentioned it, he talked about the North American businesses. Yes, there was more than one North American business. So we could have taken these numbers, extracted from them what the parties had agreed to include, back them out. That's like taking the loaf of bread and pulling out the ingredients that you weren't going to include. We could do that. In fact, Valtech did that calculation. It's in the record at 35R, reporter's record 2260, excuse me. I think I just gave you the wrong site. I did give you the wrong site. I apologize.
I'm following you. Tell us what the site is.
34, reporter's record 17.
17?
Yes. So they could do that, or they could start with the audited financial results that populated those consolidated audit financial statements and use the relevant items to calculate EBITDA as illustrated, and that's why Cornerstone would need access to Valtech Services books and records and calculation, and that's why they would this calculation would be subject to their consent with a reasonable restriction, and that's why Valtech Services is the only reading that gives meaning to the entire agreement. That's why the jury accepted it, and that's why this court should accept it. Now,
let me ask you a super quick question. It sounds like you're taking a short change. Their brief at 24, note 13, identifies the various motions that they made that raise the issues that they are bringing forward. They didn't identify the timely. I'm not at all trying to get anybody to waive anything. But what I do want to know is, did you make a motion for summary judgment on your interpretation of the contract?
We did.
It's not necessary for this appeal. Nobody needed to tell us.
Both parties made counter motions for summary judgment on the same issues.
So our trial
both
judge
were denied.
Heard you both and denied them both. Heard them at least on instructed verdict. I don't know whether you made an instructed verdict. Denied
did
it.
Not.
Did a charge that doesn't define what this clause means, just says to the jury, it's got to be complied with. And you both argued everything you're arguing here.
Exactly.
And a post-verdict motion.
The statement of the condition that was in the charge came from Cornerstone. That is their statement of the condition. So here's what did I answer your
yes, you
question?
Did. Thank you so much.
Here's what's wrong with their interpretation. It doesn't say what they want it to say. It doesn't say as shown in the consolidated audit financial statements or based on. And if they want to ignore the words pursuant to, they could have eliminated it. And the provision could have said, if the consolidated audit financial statements show that EBITDA, or they could have used the phrase, the consolidated audit financial statements shall be serving as the basis for, which that language does appear at the end of the provision, but it's not talking about the audited financial statements. It's talking about Valtech Services books and records. But here, more importantly, it would not be, contrary to counsel's comments, it would not be possible to calculate EBITDA as illustrated on Exhibit B from the consolidated audit financial statements. As I indicated, these statements are produced in accordance with international financial reporting standards. Valtech does not control what information is published in those statements. Those standards control what is published. And these were sophisticated parties. And the court, as I indicated, the court may consider, under the Sunoil decision, the circumstances surrounding the transaction. One of the circumstances specifically identified by the court in Sunoil was the sophistication of the parties. And here you had two sophisticated parties. The officers of both companies had been officers of domestic subsidiaries of European public companies. They were familiar with international financial reporting standards, and they would know, sophisticated parties with that level of understanding would know that you could not calculate a contractually defined measure of EBITDA of a contractually defined subset of assets of an individual subsidiary of a global corporate company. And that is why Cornerstone requested the addition of that final clause in the agreement, that final sentence that says that the books, records, and calculation of the seller and its agents serving as the basis for the initial payment. That is the record citation I gave, Your Honor, before. It's volume 35, page 2260. They knew that they would not be able to calculate it. And to give the Cornerstone its reading, you have to render that language meaningless. And the Texas Supreme Court does not allow that. The court, Coker v. Coker, the court must harmonize the entire agreement so that no provision is rendered meaningless. Cornerstone's reading is just too narrow, and it's not supported by the rest of the language, and it is not reasonable. Now, if the court believes it is reasonable, then if both readings are reasonable, then the agreement is ambiguous. That was a fact question for the jury, and Cornerstone challenges on a legal sufficiency basis. It's Cornerstone's burden to prove that there was no evidence to support the finding. The challenge fails if there's a mere scintilla of evidence. There is extensive evidence at trial to support this. And all of it was admissible after a finding of ambiguity. The chief operating officer, the chief financial officer, and the CPA for Valtech all testified that 2.3.2 requires a calculation of EBITDA as illustrated on Exhibit B using the year-end audited financial results to make it pursuant to the consolidated audited financial statements. The CFO testified that the auditors, upon review of those results, made no further adjustments, no error, no corrections, and that the consolidated audit financial statements, they're just a piece of evidence. They're just a part of this calculus. They're not the beginning and the end. In fact, Cornerstone CEO testified exactly to that. He said that if the consolidated audit financial statements showed a positive number, he would not have simply paid. He would have still wanted to review books and records and calculations, and he ended his statement by saying, it's just a piece of evidence. That's right. That's exactly what the parties intended. It's just a piece of evidence. It was never the intent to make that document serve as the beginning and end of this calculation. In fact, the best evidence of intent, as set forth by the Henshaw decision, 1949, Texas Supreme Court, is the parties' performance at the time as they understood them. The way they performed it is Valtech sent its EBITDA calculation as Valtech understood it, and that is as illustrated on Exhibit B, using the audited results. They sent it to Cornerstone in February, 2 months before the deadline. Cornerstone didn't reject it, saying, where are the consolidated audit financial statements? Not at all. They didn't mention the consolidated audit financial statements. They asked for one thing, a piece of Valtech Services books, records, and calculations, consistent with the agreement. They asked for an accounts receivable roll forward. They didn't even mention the consolidated audit financial statements until June when they were responding to Valtech's formal demand. And even then, they mentioned it and they ended their letter by saying that they were in the process of engaging auditors to audit the calculation. If they thought they were going to make this calculation from the consolidated audit financial statements, there would be no reason to retain their own auditors. That wasn't the intention.
The jury fully rejected Cornerstone's unreasonable construction of the agreement, and so did the trial court several times through summary judgment, directed verdict, and post-verdict motion. And this is their fifth attempt now.
That is correct, Your Honor. And we think it should be their last. The final point I'll make is they challenged the timeliness of Valtech's notice, but they admit in their briefs that they received the notice, the formal demand, after an informal calculation. They received it 4 days before. There's nothing in Texas law that supports the suggestion that a notice has to be perfect for it to be effective. We request that the court enter judgment and affirm the judgment in favor of Valtech.
Thank you.
May it please the court, David Cole in rebuttal. For the appellant, two technical questions. Justice Evans, you noted our footnote 13 on page 24, which is the answer to your earlier question, Justice Partita Kipnis, as to the specific rulings that are challenged in our challenge to the judgment entered here. Page 36 of our brief has an additional citation where I believe the notice issue was also raised in post-trial briefing, in addition to referring back to that footnote. Substantively, the argument, the big picture of the commercial context that Valtech tries to ground its reading of this contract in is uncertainty. We didn't know. There was uncertainty about what we were doing. So let's accept that premise. Let's consider an environment in which there is uncertainty. We're not sure what to do. What then are the parties likely to have agreed upon? Is it really likely that we would have agreed to a contractual framework for this final payment where they could put in whatever numbers they wanted, even if they were wrong? That's the upshot of their position. Data by itself, no matter how reliable and wonderful that data may be, is worthless unless it is organized into a calculation. Audited financial statements that are published, that they published, don't have a bunch of data. They don't say, here's Valtech's data for 2015, investing world and regulators, take a look at this. No, they have financial statements that compile, organize, and present that data. That is the critical process to distill information and uncertainty into something reliable that can be a reasonable foundation for people to do business. That's why that is in there. And the reason why their reading of Exhibit B doesn't work is it allows an incorrect application of EBITDA. It might not measure operating income if you slavishly follow the categories that are in there and insert the incorrect numbers. The point of having audited financial statements is to solve that problem as well. Have someone look at these numbers and remove the uncertainty to at least a level that is satisfactory to the market. The argument is made that, well, we're French and European, and there are exotic European rules that in some way precluded our ability to obtain an audited financial statement as required by this contract as to this specific set of issues. You can look high and you can look low in the trial record. You will not find that. I gave a citation in my opening to the examination of their chief financial person who describes how they had no trouble at all putting in the calculation that they did about the American business. And there is nothing to suggest that it was impossible to do otherwise, nor is there a jury submission, finding, issue on appeal, or anything else about impossibility of performance, a consideration problem, or some such. It is simply an interesting that they would like that to be the case, but they have no evidence of that. There is no legal authority they cite on this point. They agreed to it in the contract, and the evidence shows that the auditors would audit for purposes of the financial statement, something that there was a reasonable basis to ask them to do, as they, in fact, did in summarizing the performance of these businesses. Technical point, it is correct, and you read the testimony about this, that the line item at the bottom involves a combination of two businesses, one that was essentially just carrying some loss associated with a lawsuit. That's why I put the arrow where I did in the middle, which is more tailored to the performance of the business at issue in this case. Then there's this argument about assets and business. But what the APA says is business. That is a defined term. It is distinct from the definition of assets that is used elsewhere in this agreement. The parties knew what they were doing. They chose the word business. And that is that. They didn't go and look for the calculation, and how that gets audited is up to them. But the fact that they chose the word business to define the set of financials that would be used to calculate this calculation when they think it may have had a tighter connection to something else, that is second-guessing. You cannot rewrite the unambiguous terms of a contract like that. They agreed to business. Business has a meaning. And we talk about the overall structure of the agreement in our reply brief. Finally, this question you posed, Justice Evans, about, well, this had to have looked at the data had to have been sent to the auditors. Our citations to this are in our brief. Exhibit B and their IPA calculation never sent to the auditors. So there may be some underlying data that found its way to the auditors. Again, the footnotes and citations are all in the briefing. But that actual document where they actually did something with it never went there. Never. And so if that was the requirement, the auditors pass over it in some fashion, maybe some raw numbers. But what they sent to us, they never saw the auditors. And even in their world, that should be dispositive.
Thank you. Do you have any questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent briefing and your excellent arguments today. Your arguments help us in writing our opinions. This case will be submitted on the record in the briefs, and we will issue our opinion in due time. And Mr. Cole, be sure you go back and write good stuff about us on your little blog. Thank you.
I'll see what I can do.